Okay, welcome all back to these lectures of Principles of Banking. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. So it seems that we have a fair amount of students here following also the lectures, even though some of you might have been following the last night's debate between the Vice President Joe Biden and current president of the US, Mr. Trump, but hopefully none of you are too tired to follow also this lecture. Okay, so we now have lecture number 10. And yesterday I ended the presentation to this slide where I discussed the idea of using macroprudential policy and monetary policies to regulate the funds and markets or the banking sector for the purposes of stopping the development of crisis to a complete systemic crisis that is based on the emergence of some kind of funds and market crisis. And Jari-Mikko Meriläinen will be discussing about the role of these macroprudential policy tools, and especially the regulation based on the Basel Treaty 1, 2, and 3, especially focusing on the Treaty number 3 regarding the specific, let's say, balance sheet-based measures that the financial regulator is nowadays following very actively regarding the performance of the banking sector. So Jari-Mikko will be discussing in more details next week about those things. And here in this lecture, we will be focusing more on the real conduct of monetary policy actions. What does it mean when we say that the central bank is doing monetary policy actions? What is it actually doing and why is it doing these things? And what is it supposing to have an effect on in the real economy? Okay, so we are talking about the tactics. What is the right policy instrument for the central bank to be used when it's conducting its monetary policy actions? And we have to make a clear distinction between the tools and the policy instruments that are the real-life operating instruments that the central banks are using for the purposes of monetary policy operations. So the tools can be denoted to be in each and every central bank, basically, not just in the Federal Reserve System, but also in the ECB system, and also in all the other modern central banks. They can be classified to be based on using open market operations that we discussed already yesterday. Then they can use the reserve requirements, and they can use the pricing of discount loans, which means that they will be using specific discount rates for the individual banks that are in need for discount loans to meet their liquidity requirements or liquidity needs. So these are the tools. These are the ones where the central bank is always the main acting partner or the main counterpart. And the other counterparties in these cases are always the individual banks. And the open market operations take place there in the interbank markets. So all the banks can participate to these open market operations, but the main counterparty is usually the central bank. It's either buying or selling these open market assets. And in the Federal Reserve System, for example, these are the treasury funds. So they are originally government issued assets that are being traded there in the secondary markets. And then when we talk about policy instruments, we are referring to the actual operating instruments. So the central banks, based on these tools that they are using, are affecting on the amount of reserve aggregates in the banking system, or to the interest rates, And both of these guys here, both the reserve aggregates and interest rates, may be linked to a specific announced intermediate target. One example for an intermediate target to be can be, for example, a target for the growth rate of monetary aggregates, which means the supply of money. And usually when the central banks want to announce something about these intermediate targets, they are referring to the amount of M2, the second most liquid form of money supply. So for example, before the financial crisis, many of the Western central banks had as an intermediate target an annual growth rate of money supply measured by the measure M2 to be at the level of 4%. And based on their modeling procedures, they had an idea that this 4% growth rate of M2 on an annual basis is closely linked or analogous to a 2% inflation rate in the economy. So obviously, we will be going through in more details in terms of basic economic theories, what is the link between inflation and money supply in this lecture. But in practical terms, before the global financial crisis, when everything basically changed, many of the Western banks had this kind of intermediate target. That it's a very clear measure. It is something that the people usually, or at least the banking sector, professionals at the banking sector, immediately understand what is the relationship between M2 and other monetary aggregates, and what is their connection to the general inflation rate. And by definition, all the central banks have to acknowledge that these targets are incompatible. So they basically have to choose one or the other. They cannot choose both. So this is not a multiple optimization procedure for the central banks, actually. So there are three criteria for choosing these policy instruments. First of all, they have to be observable, and you have to be able to measure those. So you have to be able, for example, to measure the amount of money during the measurement period when you are measuring that. How much do the banks, for example, have their holdings in terms of the items that are included to M2, for example? They have to be controllable, which means that the controllability is referring to the controllability of the central bank. They should have a role in terms of having an effect on the amount of these, for example, M2 assets. And they should be predictable, they should be having a predictable effect on goals. So the main idea is that based on using these policy instruments, the central banks can have an effect on their monetary policy goals. And the monetary policy goals are most usually based on real economic measures. So they are focusing on inflation and they are focusing on real economic activity. So basically, in terms of the actual performance or doing these monetary policy actions, the so-called Taylor rule has been one of the main, specifications that the central banks are using in terms of their monetary policy rules. So there is a lot of debate going on at the moment whether this kind of representations for monetary policy rules might still be valid during these unconventional monetary policy regimes. But there's also some research, very recent research, that actually speaks in favor of having these kind of rules still working to a degree in the real economies and in terms of the performance of monetary policy. So the original idea comes from a very famous paper published by, written by John Taylor. It was published in 1993 already, and it was based on his empirical findings regarding the US economy from 1950s up until late 1970s. actually up until 1980s, beginning of 1980s, he was able to find out that in terms of the monetary policy actions that the Federal Reserve had been performing in those days, the Fed funds target rate that we discussed actually yesterday in the lectures, the federal funds markets should be the main monetary policy instrumental markets where the banks take part and the central bank is the key performer there. So the central bank sets a target level for the federal funds rates. If it sees that the level is not going to be met, let's say the level of 2%, then it will engage either in selling or purchasing the open market assets. So it is based on John Taylor's findings. He was able to prove that it would seem to be the case that the Fed funds target rate was clearly in connection to the inflation rate that was observed in the economy and to an equilibrium real Fed funds rate. So obviously here, it seems to be the case that the Federal Reserve was taking into account the effect of inflation rate when they calculated the long-term equilibrium value for the Fed funds rate in real terms. And then half of the inflation gap and half of the output gap would have an effect on the Fed funds rate target. So these are kind of a weights for the inflation gap and for the output. So what do these mean? Inflation gap means the deviation of the actual inflation from some kind of target that the central bank has in its mind. And it's usually in connection to the NAIRU level of real economic activity, which means that NAIRU means non-accelerationally inflation rate of unemployment. So this is a fairly complicated system actually, because we see that this real economic activity is obviously related to the level of unemployment. The higher is the real economic activity at the moment, the lower is rate of unemployment. So obviously this inflation rate is also in connection to this real economic activity. So these variables here are basically strongly tied together. So stabilizing real output based on this connection between these two guys here is obviously very important concern for the central bank. An output gap is an indicator for the future inflation. And this idea is based on the so-called Phillips curve. And the Phillips curve actually gives an idea that during the period of high inflation, there's basically no unemployment or there's no willing unemployment. Everyone that is unemployed is there unemployed only because of he or she is finding a new job. So it's about frictional unemployment. And there's some rate of structural unemployment also in the economy, which means that people are changing from a certain professional to another. So basically, the economics is working at the full capacity in this case. So, and this seemed to be a fairly simple empirical finding that actually seems to be holding in the US economy. So here is the Taylor rule-based development of the interest rate. So this is basically kind of a fitted value or the calculated value based on this equation from the US economy from the 1960s up until 2016 actually here. So it seems to be that if we compare this Taylor rule-based interest rate to the federal funds rate, the actual Fed funds rate that was observed in the markets at those times, then we see that especially during the change points, these two curves seem to be moving together. There are some clearly deviating periods between these series, actually, but this can be explained based on changing suddenly the monetary policy targets. Like, for example, here, the central bank was fighting against increasing inflation rate in the US economy based on the oil crisis, in my first oil crisis and the second oil crisis. So the Fed funds rate was strongly increased. But if you calculate the Taylor rule-based interest rate, it's actually capturing at least part of that fight against high inflation. The main thing is that if you calculate the correlation coefficient, any standard correlation coefficient, like a Spearman correlation coefficient for this series, two time series, then up until the period of global financial crisis, you are able to find a fairly high correlation between the Taylor rule-based interest rate series and the Fed funds-based, or the actual Fed funds rate. So it seems to be something, at least, that the Federal Reserve has been following in doing the monetary policy actions, mainly through the open market operations, though. So they were affecting to the level of Fed funds rate. But the problem is that after the global financial crisis, since the collapse of the Lehman Brothers in September 2008, basically, we have observed this zero lower bound observations, or the zero observations for the Fed funds rate. And even now, it is still there in the zero level. So basically, from this point onwards, there have been lots of questions whether the Taylor rule is still working at all, for example, in the federal system or the US economy, and moreover, is it still working in the ECB level, in the European markets or in the European economy? And I would like to show you here another paper that is actually focusing on also the functioning of, so can you hear, can you see now this International Review of Economics and Finance paper?
Yes.
Okay. So that's one of the papers that we have written in this UVASPLA International Macro and Finance Research Group. I started this project already in 2013, but Kari Heimonen and Samu Karkkainen joined me at the towards the end of this process, and we wanted to analyze the role of other than just real economic-based information in the functioning of the Taylor. So we introduced stock market information and exchange rate, or the currency market information, to the analysis of this Taylor rule. And we actually found out that the data after the starting of the euro area, or the third phase of the European Monetary Union, up until the end of 2016, it seems to be the case that the Taylor rule in its original form, which is just a representation for steering, main steering interest rates or very short-term interest rates and the real economic activity deviations and inflation deviations from their long-term target values, it's actually not performing very well anymore. And it's fairly understandable if we take into account the huge role of unconventional monetary policy actions since 2008. And we wanted to introduce, or originally I had this idea that perhaps the stock market information in some form, you can get the information based on just simple returns or changes in prices or price per book values or something like that. But from the so-called Gordon dividend growth model that I'm also researching in that more recent paper that I have mentioned to you regarding the COVID-19 period. So it's actually the model that we are using here to introduce this additional information is basically the same kind of Gordon dividend discount model. So we included the dividend yield and also real exchange rate to the estimation of the Taylor rule for the OECD countries. And we were actually able, so here's perhaps a good example for you in terms of how to formulate a standard academic research report. How do you want to sort of give the current interest regarding this theme in the introductory section? So you are referring to the most recent papers that have been focusing similar kind of things or questions. And then you want to highlight the actual things that you are doing in this analysis that you're focusing now. And we wanted to highlight the role of additional information in the estimation of the Taylor rule. So whether the stock market information, and in our case, we are able to sort of give the background for including the stock market information in the form of dividend yield, which means the dividend per price ratio, and in the form of real exchange rate to this original Taylor rule, whether they have a role to play in kind of a saving the performance of the real economic activity targets in the Taylor rule. So do the real economic targets actually get more weight if we introduce also these additional prominent variables to the analysis of Taylor? So we basically wanted to augment this Taylor rule simply, and we start from the standard representation. We refer to this one paper that is most at that time when I started this project in 2013, Castro had published a paper, and so in the derivation of the estimation model, we followed the Castro paper quite a lot, and were able to give the general representation for an augmented Taylor rule in the form of regression model. So don't get too frightened about when I speak about regressions or linear regressions or regression analysis. You will be introduced to these things in the time series course very thoroughly, and we will be using, or I will be using as an example, these papers that I have most recently written, so that you can get the grip of the ideas on how to do these empirical analysis regarding these interesting phenomena in the finance and macroeconomic relationships, for example. So this is the basic representation for the Taylor rule that we are analyzing. So it actually allows here, based on the ideas of Castro, that you can also actually have some additional variables having an effect on the interest rate, and this vector of X variables includes, in our case, the dividend yield and the real exchange rate. And also, in the most recent literature, after the original publication of John Taylor, most of the Taylor rule examinations have actually included this smoothing effect to the analysis, which means that the past observations of the nominal interest rates do have a role to play in explaining the current observation for the nominal interest rate. So it's a series, the nominal interest rate is a series that has a fairly long memory. That is the interpretation for that. So in terms of purely time series analytical models, you could basically use only autoregressive models to model the current behavior of the nominal interest rate. So you'd only include the lagged values of that same series. I will introduce you to these models also very thoroughly in the time series course in January. But the main thing here is that we wanted to use the most recent versions of the Taylor rule that had been used in the empirical analysis, and we wanted to add the additional information that we had an idea of that might be important. So next we had to give an idea about the theoretical relationships based on which we could be including to a model where we have also the nominal interest rates and the real growth expectations as they are in the Taylor rule, and also inflation expectations that are also constituents of the standard Taylor rule. They could be included to this kind of model. So we are using the Gordon growth model for the dividend yield that can be actually given in this form, that the real growth rate can be given to be dependent on the dividend yield with a negative effect from the dividend market or the stock markets. And the future inflation expectations are also related to the dividend yield D here. And real exchange rate is actually related to the difference between the foreign country and domestic country dividend yields. So these are the important new things that we want to introduce to the model. Because the dividend rate would seem to have a clearly an effect on the real growth and inflation, then obviously if it's affecting these guys and it's affecting the real exchange rate, obviously also the real exchange rate has to be included to the testing or empirical analysis of the Taylor. This was the simple idea that we wanted to analyze in our paper, and then we started doing the empirical analysis. We will go actually this, perhaps, I'm not sure whether I will give you examples of the actual regressions in the time series course, but nevertheless, the final empirical Taylor rules or the regression equations that we wanted to analyze were first the simple Taylor rule without additional variables, but with this smoothing parameter that had been used in the previous study. So basically this alpha zero here refers to that long-term real rate of interest that the central bank actually is targeting. And then we have this actual inflation and deviations of real economic activity from its long-term equilibrium values, and then the smoothing effect of the past observations regarding the nominal interest rate. Then we wanted to analyze so-called opportunistic Taylor rule, because nowadays when we have observed for a longer period of time that the inflation rate has gone down quite significantly in most of these countries, we are analyzing 14 OECD countries, and each and every one of those inflation rate has gone down. So it's only realistic to assume that nowadays the Taylor rule is actually an opportunistic Taylor rule, which just means that it has a time-varying inflation target. So the deviation of inflation from its trend value should be included to this regression model for the Taylor rule. That's the main message from that. And then as the third representation, we augmented even more this so-called second version, this opportunistic Taylor rule, and wanted to include the dividend yield and the real exchange rate to the model. And we started doing very standard, ordinary least-squares regressions with corrections for the behavior of the error term here for the Heteroskedastic and autocorrelate. Don't get too worried about these terms, because I will explain them very carefully to you. What does it mean when we are using new inverse correction, for example, for the estimation of errors in these kind of regression models? But the main thing here is that we do get a role for these additional variables. So we are here estimating first the forward-looking Taylor rule. Let's not go into the details too much, but let's now go into the discussion of the role of the additional variables. So they are given here. So we wanted to introduce these additional instruments from the stock and currency markets to the analysis and wanted to especially focus on whether they have a role to do in estimating these traditional forward-looking data rules without additional instruments. And the main message from this actually is you will get to understand these things is that are we able to increase the amount of significant parameter estimates for the standard regression coefficients when we include the instruments? And the main message is that we are able to do that because these values actually get, in most cases, they get higher and they also get more statistical significance, for example, in this Japanese case. So we have estimated all these models for different settings of countries, for big countries outside the EMU, and for example here, for small countries in the EMU, European Monetary Union. And the main message from all these tables is actually that first of all, for example, these parameter estimates for the inflation expectations, they get to be higher in absolute terms. So for example, in this case, it's more negative. And moreover, one of the main important things here is that they get to be more statistically significant. So it seems to be that the additional information that is being quoted or taken from the stock markets and the currency markets, it's relevant, but it's not actually one of the policy targets in the Taylor rule. It's something that has an effect on targeting the real economic activity and inflation deviations, but only as an instrumental information. So the central bankers are acknowledging that these guys, stock market information and real exchange rate or the currency market information do have an effect on the main targeting variables, inflation deviations and real economic activity, but they should not be treated as actual policy variables. So they are not included into the actual Taylor rule, but they have an effect on the variables that are being targeted, which are the real economic activity deviations and inflation. And it would seem to be the case and that in most cases actually, because this parameter or this variable here gets statistically significant. So these stars or these asterisks refer to the statistical significance. So this information here from inflation deviations is relevant to determining the current observations for the nominal interest rate, and it has a negative effect on that, and it is a statistically significant effect actually. But one of the relevant things here is that it's get to be even more important. So the Taylor rule is opportunistic, clearly. The inflation target is not constant, it's time varying, and there is a relevant role from the information from the stock markets and currency markets in this analysis. So especially in having effect on the opportunistic or the role of the time-varying inflation target through the stock markets and currency markets is relevant. So this was a long project. It took almost 4 years to get it published and at least three referee rounds, but we were able to do this actually finally when Samu Kärkkäinen was willing to do the final gathering of the data and rerun all the estimations that I had done using the so-called real-time observations for these real economic activity and inflation variables. Real-time observations means that it's actually not appropriate to use in the even the standard Taylor rule estimations. It's not appropriate to use the exposed observations that are kind of the old information in that situation when the central bank is doing the decisions regarding the steering rates. They are focusing on the current information that they have available for the real economic performance and inflation forecasts. So they are focusing on the real time. That is not the actual final estimate, for example, real economic activity. For example, for the GDP observations, gross domestic observation, product observations, the final figures are published only about 1 or 1.5 years after the first publication of the estimate for the real economic activity. So these real-time observations are the relevant ones. And using those actually strengthened our results. So it was a very good suggestion from the referee, even though it meant that everything had to be done again, get all the data from all the countries, starting from the beginning. And it was a laborious job to do. And someone was willing to do that and also focus on this. And this is now will be included as one article to his PhD thesis. Okay, but this, as you see, I'm very excited about these things. I love doing empirical analysis. I would very much love to see that each and every one of you would somehow get the idea of doing these empirical analysis, because to my mind, the theoretical models do not have very much to say to us in terms of practical economists if they are not holding in real time. If we are not able to produce the results that the theoretical models are saying based on actual data from the markets. Okay, so let's now go back to these slides, discussion about the Taylor rule. So are you able to see now that old Taylor rule slide again?
Yes.
Okay, good. So let's go now and have a discussion about the theories behind these monetary policy rules and these monetary policy activities that the central banks are nowadays doing. So for some of you, we will be going through some concepts that are not familiar to you because you have not been majoring in economics in your previous studies. So I will try to explain each and every concept very carefully so that you will be able to understand. But if you have some questions about these measuring these things or definitions, then just send me an email or I can give you some more references to the standard textbooks of economics. So you will be able to find those from there. So when we start the discussion about the monetary policy actions, the standard theoretical model that economists usually have in mind is the so-called quantity theory of money. And it's based on the ideas of Irving Fisher already in 1920s and also Milton Friedman that actually got the Nobel Prize from these ideas or this theoretical thinking about these models. And the starting idea there is that we should be able to somehow give a connection between the behavior of real economic agents in terms of their purchasing willingness of consuming the goods and the real economic activity. So we have already learned now that the money supply obviously has a role there in terms of this behavior. So we can write this relationship in terms of this equation of exchange, which means that we have some amount of money in the economy, and we observe some level of the aggregate prices for consumption goods, for example. We have some amount of aggregate income. So these can be measured from an individual economy basically all the time. So we can define that the aggregate nominal income is based on the price level times the real aggregate output. So P times Y gives us the nominal value of the real aggregate output at the moment. But in terms of consumption behavior, one of the key things here is the velocity of money. And by definition, it means that we can measure the velocity of money based on the average number of times per year that a currency unit is spent. So if you make a cross mark to a certain note, dollar note or euro note, how many times would you get that note to your hands in earlier times? But when we now take into account that the increasing rate of electronic payment system, electronic payment system has decreased the role of actual money. So this is referring to the role of actual money or the cash in the economy. Perhaps this velocity of money has actually decreased. So you get to be to having that same dollar in your hands much less frequently than in earlier times nowadays that we are using these electronic forms of payment. But nevertheless, the same ideas actually do hold. You would be interested in getting the same electronic markings of your holdings of money. When do you get the next time those markings to your account? But nevertheless, we can denote this equation of change in this form. So the amount of money times the velocity of money should be equal to the nominal income value, or the price level times the real income value. So from early stages already, we have noticed that the velocity is fairly constant in short run in modern economies. Aggregate output in this theory should be referring to the full employment level. So the capacity in the economy is in full use. This is the first a bit problematic assumption in this model, because it's not always the case, obviously, that the capacity is in full use. For example, nowadays, this does not hold at all because the capacities are not in full use. But this is a standard case for the theoretical thinking of these relationships. In normal times, it should be basically holding that there is no structural unemployment in economy at the moment. Changes in money supply affect only the price level. That's one of the key ideas in this thinking, and movement in the price level results solely from change in the quantity of money. So the main idea, for example, Milton Friedman, was that inflation is, in original terms, it's only about the quantity of money in the economy. So the only thing that affects the money supply or the amount of money in the economy has an effect on is the general price level or the inflation. So in terms of these theoretical equations, we can write this quantity theory of money in terms of the demand for money. So if we demand that quantity equation, divide that both sides by the velocity of money, we get from each and every time point amount of money that it should be equal to the nominal aggregate income divided by the velocity. And one of the main assumptions in this model is that the money market is always supposed to be in equilibrium. So basically, if there is a change in the money demand for some reason or other, for example, the customers or the agents' preferences increase so that they want to have more money for their purchases, the central bank is willing to supply all the money that is needed. So it restores the equilibrium in the market. So let's define that the demand for money is a constant share of the aggregate income. So demand for money obviously comes from the consumption needs or consumption purposes. Some amount of the aggregate income in nominal terms is being used for consumption purposes. So the level of transactions generated by a fixed level of nominal income determines now the quantity of money demand. The problem in the original idea of Fisher's model, or also actually in the Friedman analysis, is that Here we assume that the money demand is not affected by interest rates. And that is a bit ridiculous thing. Basically, all the consumption decisions in all times would be only defined based on the amount of income that people have. So the interest rates or the interest yield, for example, from investment assets or investing to assets would not have a role to play there. And this is something that is a bit ridiculous at the moment, actually, or nowadays. So from this idea, at this moment, we are still assuming that the demand for money is not affected by interest rates. So based on this equation of exchange, we get this quantity theory of money that gives us the relationship between the nominal income and the money supply and the velocity that is assumed to be fairly constant in short-term analysis. So this now transforms the equation of the change into the quantity theory of money, which states that nominal income or spending is determined solely by movements in the quantity of money. So in this framework that is denoted to be connected to the so-called classical school of economics, economists, we think that the wages and prices are completely flexible. So there are no price pressures or inflation pressures from, for example, the negotiation of wages. So they believe that the level of aggregate output is produced in the economy during normal times should remain at the full employment level, so there's no unemployment. All the capacity in the economy is being at full use. So if we divide these both sides by this real activity, we can then write this price level based on this representation that it is mostly connected positively to the supply of money and to the velocity, but negatively to the real economic activity. So when we want to find the relationship between the amount of money and inflation, that basically is actually relevant. It seems to be relevant already from the thinking of these functioning of the Taylor rules nowadays. So we first have to realize that when we are talking about inflation, we are talking about relative changes in the price level. Be always careful also in your own analysis when you are talking about levels and when you are talking about differences. Inflation is by definition a difference in the level of price levels. So in this case, we just are utilizing the standard idea from the principles of using logarithms, for example, that you can approximate a percentage change or a relative change in some variable by using logarithms. So percentage change in the multiplication of x by y, so the income of x by y, is equal to the percentage change in x plus the percentage change in y. So this just comes from the idea of applying the rules for logarithmic calculation. So log of x times y is by definition equal to the log of x plus log of y. And we are using the log change as a percentage approximation of the percentage change in x. So when we use this mathematical fact, we can actually write the equation of exchange based on this. So this is the same equation of change that was originally given for the levels of these variables. We can now write it for the differences or the relative changes in percentage values for these same variables. So here is a change in the money supply, amount of money in the economy. Here is the change in the velocity. And here is a change in the price level, which means inflation. And here is the change in the real economic activity. So if we subtract, we want to get rid of real terms here, basically, originally. So we subtract the real activity change from both sides of this equation. And remember that the inflation rate is the growth rate of the price level. So we denote it by pi. This is the usual notation for inflation rate in macroeconomic literature. So inflation is the relative change in percentage values of the price level based on this equation of exchange and the money supply ideas or the quantitative theory of money. It should be in equilibrium, it should be equal to the percentage change in the money supply plus the percentage change in the velocity, when we assume that the velocity nevertheless can be changing, minus the percentage change in the real economic activity. So, since we assume that the velocity here in short term can be constant or usually has been constant, so its growth rate is zero, so the quantitative theory of money is also a theory of inflation. So inflation is completely dictated by the relative difference between the nominal amount of money minus the percentage change in the real economic activity. So that gives you the idea why the central banks even nowadays are focusing quite a lot to the development of the amount of money in the economy, because it's clearly in connection to inflation. The higher is the growth rate of money, in normal times it should be the case that inflation is increasing. And actually currently, now that we observe these huge amounts of liquidity, so the amount of money is huge. We observe that it's about 8,000 trillion dollars in the US economy based on the extension of that central bank balance sheet that we observed yesterday. It's only rational, or it's very intuitive, that the economists are a bit afraid of huge inflation spikes somewhere in the future. Because based on this standard, very simple quantitative theoretic analysis, it's actually the nominal money supply is by definition in connection to inflation. But for some reason or other at the moment, the money supply, the increased rate of money supply, it's not being transferred to real economic activity, and hence it's not being transferred to inflation also, because we observed already before that real economic activity is in connection to inflation. It's not being transferred. Changes in money supply are not being transferred to inflation and real economic activity at the moment. So this mechanism is not working well at the moment. But in earlier times, before the global financial crisis, before the huge extension of the central bank's balance sheets, actually, this has been a valid relationship. So when we draw the inflation rate and the money growth rate for based on decade-wise increases, so we have noticed that they are mostly in a positive connection, and especially if we draw these connections between the interest rate, inflation rate and money growth rate for the more modern era of observations, like from 2003 to 2013, we obviously see mainly a positive relationship between money growth rate on average, in average terms, and the inflation rate. So countries with high money growth rate also have high growth rate of general prices, except for Japan. Japan has been experiencing a so-called liquidity trap for periods already, for long periods already, since from the beginning of 1990s. So actually this equation of exchange or money supply ideas are not working, have not been working actually in the Japanese economy for a longer period of time now. Okay. And in terms of observations for the US economy, we have seen some periods of high money growth, but also in connection to low inflation. So we have been seeing actually some periods when this positive relationship between inflation and money growth has actually not been holding. So we have not observed high rates of growth in money supply in connection to the high rates of inflation. So we have observed some problematic situations actually here already. So it's not de facto, it's not completely one-to-one relationship, even though we have observed cases where the inflation rate is clearly positively connected to the money supply rate or the M2 growth rate. So in some early periods. So basically, if we consider the paper by John Taylor regarding the functioning of the Taylor rule, he actually was using this period of data for his analysis. And we, here we obviously see that the standard ideas in the quantity theory of money actually are holding. So basically also the Taylor rule might actually be holding quite well in this period. But the period after that is actually a bit problematic. So lots of other things seem to have been playing a role in also the relationship between the money growth and also the money growth and the inflation rate. So perhaps in this period of time, actually the standard quantity theory of money might not have been holding. Even though we have here also clear connections, even though the absolute levels are clearly different, we have some periods when the positive changes in the inflation are connected to positive changes in the money growth rate, but we have also these problematic situations, at least from the onset of the global financial crisis. And nowadays, these things are clearly the connection between these two guys. It's clearly, it has broken down completely. So what about the budget deficits? Budget deficits are now also playing a big role, because we obviously see at the moment that the public budgets are going to a very strong deficits in each country due to the corona crisis. We experienced this same situation already after the global financial crisis. So what do our theoretical ideas say about these things? So basically, you should recognize that by definition, there are two ways for the public sector or the government to pay for the spending. They can either raise the revenue, which means that they are increasing the general tax rates. They can increase indirect taxes or income taxes or environmental taxes, but nevertheless, they are increasing the tax rates. Or alternatively, if they don't want to increase the tax rates, so they want to have the purchasing power of the other sectors of the economy to be fairly constant, not at least changed based on the behavior of the government sector or taxation, they can borrow. The other alternative is to take more loans from the markets. So they can raise revenue by levying taxes or go into the markets to issue new debt. You have to remember here that all the debt that is being gathered for paying the government expenses more has to be taken from the primary markets, obviously, because the secondary market quotations are the important one. That's not the market for getting funding for your expenditures, it's the primary market. But the secondary markets have a big role in easing up. When the liquidity in the secondary markets is high, then it's obviously easier for also to have the primary market issues being going on. So issues in the primary markets for government debt are easier to be done when the secondary market liquidity is high, because the government assets are selling at a good price. Government can also create money that's a bit problematic idea here. Basically, we are now moving towards this situation where the governments are creating money based on the central banking activities. So basically, at the ultimate stage, it might be theoretically actually possible that all the government expenses are being paid by issuing new money or creating more money by the central bank. But originally, that should not be the case. Fiscal policy decisions or public spending should be distinct thing compared to the monetary policy decisions or creating new money. But obviously, it's a possibility. So the intertemporal government budget constraint, so it means the budget constraint over time, reveals us actually two important facts. So if the government deficit, which means the difference between the expenditures and income or income sources of the government sector, if it's financed by an increase in the bond market holdings by the public, there's no effect on the monetary base and hence on the money supply. But if the deficit is not financed by the increase from bond holdings of the other sectors, the monetary base and the money supply will increase. If the central bank decides to come to the market and finance the public deficits. So basically, at the moment, the situation is going towards this direction because the central banks have been heavily buying the government assets from the banking sector during these quantitative easing programs. Hyperinflations are something that are really problematic. They are actually something that can be generated based on these huge extensions of the central bank balance sheets. But at the moment, it seems to be the case that we are not in danger of facing this situation. But they are, by definition, they are periods of extremely high inflation that is referring to the levels of over 50% per month. So we have hundreds of persons per year in terms of changes in the general prices in this case. So there have been lots of economies in the past history, mostly Latin American economies and in developing countries that have experienced these periods of hyperinflation, but not usually in the Western economies. In Germany, we experienced during the First World War II actually a period of hyperinflation, but not after that actually in the Western economies at all. African countries are in some cases classified to have been experiencing also this hyperinflation period. So there actually the activities of the central banks have a key role there in trying to control this inflation development there. But obviously, what is the main worry or what is the main reason for being worried about this hyperinflation that we may have in the near future if this extremely unconventional monetary policy actions generate to a sudden spikes in the inflation in the near future? The main reason for worrying about this situation is that it obviously introduces a lot of uncertainty to the economy. If inflation is high, obviously the interest rates are going to be high also because the central bank will start fighting against that inflation. They try to have a control on the inflation. First, they try to have a control on expected inflation and then also on actual inflation through having effects on the expected inflation. But they might actually, in that case now, especially that we are experiencing really bad times in the real economic activity, if they increase the interest rates too much, then the real economic activity will for sure suffer from that. So that is really a frightening future that we have now if this, for some reason or other, continues for a longer period. Because we are now generating these fears of hyperinflation in the near future. But we will see what happens in the economy. Nevertheless, uncertainty is already increasing, has increased quite a lot. So people are fairly uncertain about the future now, because the general indexes that describe the people's expectations about the future have been increasing quite a lot. And the main reason is at the moment is the corona crisis. But luckily, if there's anything that can be said to be a fortunate thing in this, is that actually this is both a supply and demand crisis. So prices are not increasing on the base of excess demand, actually, or sudden changes in the prices of raw materials, for example, like oil prices, because they have come down also quite strongly due to this slack in the demand. So this is a specific situation now that we are living in periods of time. Then, if we want to take a step towards a bit perhaps more relevant thinking in terms of these money market analysis or the money market equilibrium analysis, we should be focusing on these Keynesian theories of money demand. So we will be discussing about this liquidity preference theory of Milton or Keynes, John Maynard Keynes. And the main question there is the reasons why the individual want to hold money. And by definition, the Keynesian analysis approves that there are at least three motives for people to hold money holdings. First one is the transaction motive. So there's a demand that is proportional to income, but payment technologies have also an effect there. So obviously, if you are talking about the plain cash demand, then when the payment technologies have improved, the plain cash demand will go down. Then there's this precautionary motive. So the money is imagined in a way that it serves as a caution against unexpected wants, proportional to income once again. So income is the relevant factor there. And then it's as a third form of money demand motive, we have this speculative motive. So it's considered to be one form of storing the wealth in general. But the main difference here in the Keynesian analysis compared to this Fisherian or Friedman time classical school analysis is that right from the beginning, we want to make a distinction between the real values and the nominal values in the economy, especially in this case for the quantity of money. So by definition, in the Keynesian analysis, we analyze the demand for real cash balances. So the nominal money demand is divided by the aggregate price level. So we take into account actually the current situation regarding also the inflation in the economy or the current price level. In general terms, the Keynesian analysis just says that the money demand in real terms is a function of interest rate and a function of real income. And actually, this is also real interest rate that we are interested about. So it's negatively related to the interest rate and positively related to real income. So we can basically write this money demand equation in a translated form. So basically we can transform that to the other way. So when we divide the price level with the money demand, then it's equal to one over the function of money demand in with respect to interest rate and income. When we multiply both sides by y, we actually can get to this representation that resembles as the exchange equation or the quantity of money theory, actually. And we replace the equilibrium condition from the money markets that the money demand is always met by the central bank money supply. So we can have the representation in this form, basically, that the velocity can be given as a thing that is related to the income, real income, but also related to the interest rate and real income through the money demand equation. So basically, we can get to these same kind of representations for the relevant variables or the connections between relevant variables in the quantity theoretic analysis and also in the Keynesian liquidity preference analysis. So putting these three motifs together, we get to the situation where we allow that the velocity is not constant. It is dependent on other things, and the things are that are affecting there are the interest rates. So the procyclical movement of interest rates should induce procyclical movements in velocity. And it will also be dependent on the expectations about the future normal levels of interest rate changes. So basically in this analysis, we are considering the interest yielding assets as an alternative to having money holdings. So each and every agent can basically invest into money holdings in real cash terms or into interest yielding assets. So we are basically discussing this in terms of kind of a portfolio theoretical analysis. So we can extend these alternative assets also towards stock market assets, for example. So in that case, it will be involving much more risk. But in any case, we can calculate interest kind of return for also the stock market investments. So this actually expands the standard theory quite a lot. So we can base the decision here based on the idea of opportunity cost of holding more money. So the opportunity cost of holding more money here in portfolio theoretical view is the loss in the interest income if you are holding more money. So if you are holding, compared to the original situation, 50 euros, we want to hold 100 euros. So you are losing the interest yield that you would get for the additional 50 euros from the interest yielding or other asset markets. So this theory can actually justify the conclusion from the Keynesian liquidity preference function that the demand for real money balances is positively related to income and negatively related to the nominal interest rate, when we consider this opportunity cost idea of investing to either money or to interest yielding or return yielding asset markets. There are obviously other factors that have an effect on the demand for money, and those can be denoted to be, for example, the general level of wealth. When it increases, the demand for money increases. When the riskiness of other assets increases, obviously, their demand will decrease, so it have a positive effect on the demand for money, and also the liquidity of other assets is obviously, because the money is the most liquid form of your wealth, but also liquidity of the other assets is also important. So if the liquidity of other assets increases, then the demand for money decreases. Okay, so we can actually give a table about the relevant things that have an effect on the demand for money in view of the Keynesian liquidity preference and portfolio theoretical analysis. So we have a set of variables that have an effect on the money demand. We have interest rates from other assets and income in general, payment technologies, wealth, riskiness of other assets, and inflation risk. So inflation risk is actually the only component that is relevant in this case when we discuss the demand of money in the Keynesian framework, because we are analyzing the real cash balances here. So we are discussing about the purchasing power of money. So if the inflation risk increases, there's also a risk for a decreasing purchasing power of real cash balances. So basically there's a negative relationship. So money is in that case relatively more risky, and so it's less desirable. Liquidity of other assets, there's also this kind of same kind of substitution effect. So if money is relatively less liquid in this case, and so it's less desirable if the liquidity of the other assets changes, it improves. So we have now given here an idea about the relationship that the money demand has towards the interest rates. So if we think in this standard classical school, based on this standard classical school ideas, then the interest rates would not have an effect on the demand for money, and velocity is more likely to be constant, or at least it's well predicted. So the quantitative theory of this money demand says that aggregate spending is determined by the quantity of money, so it's more likely to be true in that case. But the fact is that for long periods of time already, the money demand has been quite sensitive to also the interest rates. So the more sensitive the money demand for interest rates is, the more unpredictable velocity will be. So the main idea that sort of gets to be, or the main assumption that gets to be loosened here is the idea of the stability of the velocity of money. So there is less clear link between the money supply and aggregate spending. Interest rates have a role there to play too. That's the main idea. So if in terms of, from the point of view of a central bank, if the money demand function is not stable and it experiences substantial shifts as Keynes believed, then velocity is unpredictable and the quantity of money may not be tightly linked to aggregate spending as it's in the quantity theory. So the main thing there is that interest rates might have a role to play there. So this is supporting the idea that active monetary policy that is being executed based on using the interest rates as the tool in the monetary policy actions, they should have a role in this case. So basically, this Taylor rule type of analysis can actually be seen to be based on these kind of discussions that Keynes actually also introduced to the economic thinking. So for the central bank, from the central bank's point of view, it's actually very essential for the central bank to be able to forecast the money demand in the near future. So it's very crucial for that to be able to target the interest rates. So for in the Federal Reserve case, for example, to be able to set the target level for the Fed funds rate, that is the main monetary policy instrument in the federal system. So if the money demand function is unstable, so the money supply is not closely linked to aggregate spending, then the level of interest rates that the central bank sets will provide more information about the stance of monetary policy and will the money supply. So it's about balancing the use of interest rates and the use of money supply, because the central bank has the only mandate. It's the single authority that can print money. So it's about finding the optimal balance between these. And the central bank has to, or it recognize well that they are basically two sides of the same coin. So if you are changing the supply of money, then it will have an effect on the interest rates. On the other hand, if you are changing the interest rates, then it will have an effect on the money supply or money market equilibrium. So it has to recognize this thing all the times than when it's making the monetary policy decisions. Okay, so how would these things translate into the real economic activity? I will have some time to introduce you to the main equations regarding these connections of monetary policy and aggregate economy. So for those of you that are not familiar with these kind of things and want to deepen your knowledge on the economic ideas behind this, I can suggest you several standard textbooks in economics, like the ones by Blanchard, for example, and Burdan Hyplot. So send me an email if you want to have a deeper understanding for the macroeconomic models that are playing their role here when we do this kind of analysis for the monetary policy action. Send me an email so I will give you some references regarding the standard macroeconomic books. The Mishkin book actually gives some ideas about this, but since the focus of the book is more in the banking and functioning of financial markets and the financial intermediation system, the macroeconomic analysis in that book is not very deep, because it's not the main thing, actually. But the standard way of thinking in these kind of analysis is that we use these Keynesian type of analysis. The reason for that is that the Keynesian type of analysis allows to introduce the role of interest rates to these discussions regarding the monetary policy behavior or monetary policy actions and real economic activity. So there's going to be some questions in the chat, so I will answer to those immediately after we get some slides of this. So I will introduce you to this idea of the role of so-called IS curve. The main idea in the IS curve analysis that is denoted to be type of a Keynesian analysis is that we are able to give the so-called goods market equilibrium in terms of the idea that if the goods markets are in equilibrium, all the investments, real investments, are being financed based on the aggregate level savings that the consumers are leaving after their consumption decisions. So basically, in the closed economic case, basically, we can define that all the income that the agents get from producing the aggregate level production is being used to consumption by the private sector and real investments by the firm sector. So the proceeds or the residual from consumption expenditures that are being left out from the income from producing the aggregate production are the savings. And the savings are being used for the real investments by the real productive sector, the firm sector. So that's the reason for talking about IS, investments equals savings. That is the main reason. So by definition, in this analysis, we define that the planned expenditure is the total amount of spending on domestically produced goods and services that households, businesses, the government, and foreigners want to make. And in the Keynesian analysis, we actually make the assumption that aggregate demand is the total amount of output demanded in the economy. So total quantity demanded of an economy's output is the sum of four types of spendings: consumption expenditures by the private sector, planned investment spending by the firm sector that already mentioned here, and then government purchases. So the public consumption is here, you know, to be the G, and net exports in the open economy case, which is always relevant. So the difference between exports minus imports is the net exports. So if we have a positive value, then we are exporting more than we are importing. And if we have a negative value for this, then our trade balance is in deficit, so we are importing more than we are exporting from the country. Usually all these can be calculated based on the national accounts within a year. So during the year, everything that's being consumed, invested, purchased by the government or net exported can be calculated. And we can also measure these in quarterly basis. So this is actually calculated by the national statistical offices also on quarterly basis. But the usual thing is to focus on a quarterly, focus on annual changes in these, all these variables. So by definition, the first thing that is relevant in this aggregate demand is the consumption expenditures. So in general terms, we can define a general consumption function to be given in the form of consisting of the so-called autonomous part of consumption. So this is just a part of consumption that is not dependent on the level of disposable income. The main animal here, or the main constituent of this consumption function, is this disposable income. So intuitively, you can obviously understand that if you have increases in your disposable income, then you are able to consume more. But you're not perhaps consuming all of the increased amount of disposable income, but you can be saving in relative terms a bit more at a higher level of disposable income. So this marginal propensity to consume, MPC, is actually a very relevant thing. What is the amount of consumption, increased consumption, that you want to do from each and every unit of more disposable income? So that's the definition for the marginal propensity of consumption, MPC. That's the slope of the consumption function, which means the change in consumer expenditures that results from an additional towards disposable income. And A is the autonomous part, which is not dependent. It can be inheritance, or it can be social security, or it can be, but nevertheless, it's something that is not in connection to your disposable income. So the main source for increasing your consumption is the disposable income. Then the other component for the IS curve analysis, or the goods market equilibrium analysis, is this planned investment spending. It refers to the real investments that the firm sector is willing to do. And fixed investments are always planned, because they refer to the building of factories and other production facilities. Inventory investments can be unplanned, because they refer to the more like cyclical changes in, for example, the inventories of goods or production inputs or so on. So they are much more variable. Planned investment spending is dependent on interest rates. That is the key thing here that we have to understand. Consumption is also, to a degree, if we analyze these things in the view of this Keynesian liquidity preference framework. So consumption is related to the demand for real cash balances, obviously. The higher is the general inflation rate, the more expensive it's to finance your consumption. So consumption is also at least indirectly in connection to the interest rates. But in these analyses that we will be doing tomorrow in more details, the main sort of a route for the role of interest rates come through its effects on the planned investment spending. So the higher is the interest rate, the less are the firm sector willing to do more real investments, because it's more expensive for them to get the loans, for example. The loan interest rates are higher if the general level of interest rates is increasing, or if they want to fund the building of factories, for example, from their retained earnings, then they obviously could invest those retained earnings to assets. And if the assets returns are increasing due to the increasing interest rates, then the opportunity cost is also increasing. So from that point of view, also the planned investment spending is negatively related to the interest rates. Okay. Perhaps I have to stop here because we would have some time for questions here. So if I can see the chat. Can I see it here? Yeah, there's one question. Prince is asking, is revaluation of the currency the best way of dealing with hyperinflation in the case of Zimbabwe? The best way of dealing with hyperinflation is always to increase first the interest rates, because that is something that the central bank clearly has much more power compared to the valuation of the currency. If it's increasing the interest rate, it will have more direct effect on also to the inflation than just the revaluation of the currency. Okay, any other questions? No. Okay, so we will continue directly from this tomorrow. So we will be starting the discussion from the role of net exports and then go on from that one. And those of you that felt a bit uncomfortable during this lecture when I started to discuss about these economic terms or economic concepts, then send me an email and I will give you more reference to the standard economic textbooks that will be of help to you to understand also these things. Okay, see you all tomorrow.